Hello, friends. This is your friend Kent C. Dodds, and I'm joined by my friend Cher. Say hello, Cher.
Hello, Cher.
This is actually starting to become a joke. You're the third person that I've talked with for season four, and each one so far has there's been some funny joke about hello, Cher, or hello, you know, my name. Anyway, I'm excited to chat with you. We've known each other for a while now. I can't remember. We first met online somehow. And then we did, I do remember now we met at React Rally, which seems like forever ago.
I think it kind of was.
Yeah, maybe like 2018 or something.
No, it had to have been before then because I was still at Starbucks. So it must have been 2017.
Boy, I can't believe it. Like time flies. My goodness. So it has been a long time. And yeah, it's been a pleasure to know you online. And I'd love for my audience to get to know you. So could you give us a little intro to yourself, please?
Sure. So my name is Cher. I'm a single mom. Well, I'm actually not single anymore. I got married, but I was single
Congratulations.
For a really long time. So it takes me a really long time to wait.
When my wife and I got married, she was an elementary ed teacher, and she just started her first class right after we got married, and she kept on referring to herself as Miss Jessie, and her students just thought that was hilarious. You're like, they're not Miss Jessie or Mrs. Dodds. So yeah, it does take a while to adjust.
It does. Yeah. So I taught myself how to code when I was in middle school. So that was in the late 90s. And then I had kind of a rough go of things and went down the wrong path, as people who have a rough go of things tend to do. But when I was 21, I got pregnant with my daughter. And when I was like 7 or 8 months pregnant, I just had this, all women go through this like phase where they're like, oh no, I have another human being to care for. What am I going to do? And I was living with my mom, not in her basement, but in an upstairs childhood bedroom. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have a baby and I'm living in my childhood bedroom in my mom's house and I don't have a job, you know? Well, I was a waitress, but you know, whatever. I just didn't want that life. And I had dropped out of high school and also dropped out of college. And I was the only skill I had was coding. And, you know, I didn't necessarily know that that was going to be a career at all. I was just like, I need a job and this is a thing I know how to do. And so I looked at Craigslist and there was an ad looking for something called a front end developer. And little known fact, at the time, I was the second Google result for front-end developer.
Really?
Because it wasn't really a job title. You know, this was in 2006. So, you know, it wasn't really a job title at the time. And I just had a corner on the market, you know. And so I think that, you know, when they Googled front-end developer and they saw my name and I applied for the job, it just kind of was like, oh, yeah, bring her in. And I just told them, like, what I knew, which in a technical aspect wasn't a lot. I didn't know, you know, terminology and stuff, but I remember the director of technology, who's the one who interviewed me, you know, he had was obviously having some back and forth between the panel that had interviewed me being like, she has no idea what she's talking about. And like, he brought out a printout of a web page and asked me to write HTML on paper for it. And I did that. And I think that because I had spent so much time in the CSS Zen Garden community, that like my semantic HTML, like that is all I knew. Like you style around semantic HTML. That is, you know, how I learned. And I think that that right there was like the thing that he was like, because he walked out and I heard him. He was like, he just put the piece of paper up and he's like, she's really good. He's like, and so then they offered me the job. And I mean, it wasn't very much money. It was like $30,000 a year or something, which, you know,
yeah.
Knowing now that everybody else was making double what I did, I should have like negotiated or something. But, you know, at the time it was a lifesaver. You know, I went from making $2.13 an hour as a waitress with plus tips, you know, to being like, okay, I can eventually move out of my mom's house, you know, like having a future. So that's really how I got into this career. And I spent the so that was 2006 and I didn't get the job at USA Today until 2011. So the 5 years following that was like me figuring out how to make ends meet between being working in the restaurant industry and then also doing development and learning more about development on the side to try to make myself marketable as, you know, an employee to get another job after the one that I left it. It was called luxuryrealestate.com. That was my first tech job. So it's just real estate websites.
Wow. Boy, that is really amazing to me. I can't imagine the pressure that you felt to get a job as you were getting started and to make sure that you were able to take care of your kid. And it's honestly really inspiring that you put the effort into learning to code so you could get that job. As they honestly got you for a steal, my goodness, like for 30K in the U.S. I know in other countries.
In Seattle, too. So
yeah.
Not exactly a cheap place.
Yeah, for real. So I'm really amazed. You mentioned that you knew coding. How did you get introduced to coding? Is like you mentioned that you dropped out of high school and college. Were you going into college for coding, or where did coding come from?
No. So I tried to go to college for many different things. I majored in astrophysics, medical physics. I was pre-med at one point, architecture. Wow. A lot of different, and just math period. Like I just was always really good at math. And so I tried like to use that in different ways. And I think it's just the bottom line is I'm not good at school. And even though I really enjoyed learning, which I think is part of the reason why I have done so well in this career, the structure of school is just really hard for me. Maybe because I have ADHD, maybe because I'm bipolar, maybe because I'm on the autism spectrum. Maybe all three of those things, you know, make it difficult for me. But coding itself, I think, actually came from ADHD because I was playing this video game online called EverQuest, and I had a guild that I was running. And at the time, all of the other good guilds on the server that I was on had websites to get, you know, like recruitment. And mine was the only one that didn't. And I wanted to be competitive, so I needed a website. But, you know, I was like 14 or 15 years old, so... I was in eighth grade. So, you know, how was I going to get a website? And so I just, I was on Internet Explorer and I was like looking at a website and I just right clicked it and I saw View Source and, you know, little old learn how things work brain share, you know, it's like, I bet this is how this works and I can take it apart and put it back together and make my own. And that's what I did. And I did the same thing with CSS once that came out. And then I learned JavaScript actually from, so my school had like the Adobe suite of products. And so they had Dreamweaver as one of the products available. And I would make a site in Dreamweaver using, you know, with UX features. And then I would view the source of that, go into the JavaScript files. And it was Macromedia at the time, actually, not Adobe, which is part of the story, which is why I remember. I would learn how the functions worked. But it's funny because it wasn't until like 2009, I think, when I was doing some freelance work that the guy that I was working for was like, he's like, why do you underscore all of your functions with MM underscore? And it's because Dreamweaver, all of the functions were fat for Macromedia. And I thought because they all had that all functions had to start with.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. That's so funny.
And he's like, no. He's like, is that Macromedia? He's like, did you learn how to write JavaScript from Dreamweaver? And I was like,
that is so awesome.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. That's exactly how I learned.
I love it. That's a brilliant story. That's so great. You know, that, and that to me is inspiring as well. Like, the people who learned, how to write code before it was as accessible to learn now, are really inspiring to me. I started learning, coding myself right around like Google was very popular and widely used. It was, let's see, 2011 is when I really started getting into coding. And like, yeah, you could find so much stuff. I mean, there's a lot more now than there was then, but like I could Google around and answer my questions. I didn't really, I know a lot of people are sad about bundlers and you know, code obfuscation and everything. View source means nothing now. But I didn't, I'm not one of the view source you know, kids who grew up on View Source. So I'm just really amazed by that.
I can't imagine anyone trying to learn anything from View Source now because there's too much. Like I feel so lucky that I had this enormous, you know, amount of time to learn this much information and then this much information, you know, kind of like a ladder. And now it's like, here's the whole staircase, the whole house, the mansion. Good luck. Pick a room and start there, you know? Like, I feel like I can't imagine anybody, you know, learning from ViewSource. Now we have to bundle, you know, we have to do all of these things. And that's because things have changed. And I'm not one of those get off my lawn kind of people, except for if you're actually on my lawn, then probably get off my lawn. Just kidding. You know, I think that the reason that things change is because they have to, and it's for the better. Like, we're not changing things to like make things worse and harder for people. We're changing things to make things better and more accessible, you know, as you said.
Thank you for saying that. Because there definitely is that alternative opinion of like, oh, like, it's so complicated now. But it really comes down to our expectations are bigger. Like, you would not be able to learn the stuff that our customers expect us to do from ViewSource. It would not be possible to do that. And so, yes, it is a shame that ViewSource is pretty much useless now, for the most part, unless you really know what you're doing already. There are so many resources out there for learning, and I'm glad of that as well.
When I think about like when I started, like when you were talking about, Google, like 2011, I'm like, what did I use before Google? Dogpile. It was Dogpile, and you couldn't really find anything because it was like, it was taking all of the other search engines and putting them together so that you could get all of the results of these different search engines, but it still wasn't very helpful unless you kind of knew what you were looking for. Maybe you didn't know what you were looking for and it was more broad. So, but not for like learning how to do something, especially of that nature, you know? And the other thing that I was going to say was that, you know, you're talking about our expectations are different. Like one of the first things that I ever wrote, I was writing, I was doing a website for a library. And they really wanted like cursive, not like a native browser cursive title, but they wanted something fancy. And there was no Cipher yet. So I wrote a JavaScript replacement font thing that like I had to, you know, make these individual letters in GIFs because there were no pings yet, you know, and then basically alter that to give them what they wanted. And
wow.
We don't have to do that. We expect now that we don't even have to use something like Cipher, you know, that this stuff all just inherently works and is available. And, you know, nobody's saying like, oh my gosh, look, I made a flyout menu using only CSS. Oh, look, I made it with JavaScript, but it's actually accessible. Like, these are now expectations. So with all of these various expectations, and especially speaking of accessibility, what about accessibility? Like in built, you know, we're covering all these different devices. Like, people were not visiting websites on their mobile phones in 1999, you know, like this. So we're doing a lot more and we expect a lot more out of the web applications that we're writing. So you can't expect that you would get all of that and you can still just view source, copy and paste the HTML and learn how to make a website, because websites aren't just websites anymore. We're not webmasters anymore.
Yeah. There's a big difference between a web app and a website. And even websites, though, like, we're talking about responsive design and accessibility, and you really can't be accessible without JavaScript for many use cases and stuff, as you mentioned. So there's a lot to it now. But I'm still amazed and I love the MM underscore. That is just so great. That's perfect. So thanks for sharing that, that part of your journey. As you've been getting into software, what are some of the things that you have noticed or additional things that we're expecting software to do, and some of the problem spaces that we're entering into as software is kind of eating the world?
I think artificial intelligence, machine learning, all of that stuff, like, I think that, I mean, ultimately, what is software? It's trying to do things efficiently or create efficiency in other processes. And I think as we're doing that, in some cases, it's kind of running away from us. If you look at, and there's like so many different like outcomes that are somewhat extremely negative because we're not really like, you know, thinking about it beforehand, almost like the Jurassic Park of tech. Like, it never stopped to think if they should, you know?
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
And I think about like Bitcoin and how, you know, I remember buying Bitcoin when it was not ever what it is now. It was just like, I used it maybe not for the best purposes. And I wish that I hadn't used it on what I did use it on, but I don't do those things anymore. But you know, now Bitcoin mining is an energy, like it's an environmental concern. And it's one of those things where, you know, we're trying to make things smarter and so that we don't have to work as hard. We want the machines to work harder and we work smarter. But we're not trying to make the machines, we're not thinking about how that is going to affect outside of the machines, you know, like so natural resources and humans themselves, you know, like writing biases into our software, things like that.
The impact of software on humans and humans on software, I guess when you're talking about biases, we kind of write our biases into the software. And I'd love to dive into that some more. But when you said what you said, it just kind of made me think of like the impact that software is having on humans. And I think immediately about Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and things. Not that these things are bad in themselves, but I think that these platforms should be held accountable for the impact that they are having on people. The research is pointing very directly that that Facebook is really causing problems for especially teenagers, but from a like a self-value perspective and things. And I think that, like you said, it's kind of running away from us. We didn't really think what the implications of what we are creating have.
Yeah. And I'm even just thinking about like myself as somebody with ADHD, you know, like if I showed you my browser right now, like earlier you told me you could hear the fan on my computer, and it's probably because I have like, I don't know, maybe like 70 tabs open on this particular browser. Wow. And it's like, I know that like I was keeping that sort of structure in my head a little bit, which is why, you know, like I'm like, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. But I honestly think that browser tabs have made it worse, you know, like Windows, I couldn't really keep that many open. Like eventually I would forget about it and I would close it and it wasn't a big deal. But like now, not only, you know, can I keep all of these tabs open all the time, they reopen when I lose them. And if I accidentally lose them, they're not just gone, which I probably would have never opened this stuff again. You know, that's why they're still open, you know, and it'll ask me if I want to open them again, you know, like it's gonna try really, really hard to make sure I get back to the stuff that maybe I was going to buy or, you know, which was all what it comes back down to is like, you know, and I think about too, the impact of things like likes, right? Or followers, like those sorts of things, like that has now become like an inherent part of somebody's worth. And even if you're not somebody who like, I'm not somebody who like, I don't define my worth on that. I think maybe I could have at one point, but maybe because I grew up with people having very few, it doesn't really have that big of an impact on me. But I know that when somebody that has like no followers says something extremely vile to me, I will use that as a way of like, what do you think that your opinion matters? Nobody's even following you, you know? And then it comes out of my mouth and I'm like, I don't even care about that. But like, still, it's written into me that that is something that determines your, like the worth of what you're saying to me. So maybe I'm not going to use that against somebody who is being nice to me. I'm not going to be like, oh, you have no followers, I don't care about what you say. But if you say something mean to me, it is still written into me because of, you know, being a part of this software for, you know, 10 plus years, being a part of social media and having that, you know, even back to MySpace, top 8, you know, like I'm not in your top 8. You don't even like me. Like mine's the default, man.
Yeah. That it's so interesting. Like we just haven't fully appreciated the fact that software writes us.
Yeah.
You know, software that somebody else has written is writing me. as I use it. And often the, like maybe the developer didn't think about it and maybe the product manager didn't think about it, but like all together, it just kind of, this is what happens. And now, when you throw, weird incentives in play, where, okay, well, we've got advertisers now and we've got to make sure we keep them happy or, whatever the case may be, like we've just kind of landed in this area of like the open web, everything's free. But we've got to make it sustainable. So we start putting in some weird ways to make money, which often ends up being not better for the consumer. So like Twitter and Facebook are researching ways to make their platforms more addictive. And because that's all that matters. That's what pushes the dollars forward. And yeah, that has me pretty worried about that.
Yeah, me too. Big time.
Yeah. And it's kind of like what drives more engagement? Well, it's toxicity that drives engagement. And so I actually recently stopped following people on Twitter and I use Lyst now. And so now Twitter hasn't planned around that. And so their algorithm doesn't apply to me. So it was a while ago, I saw a lot of people tweeting about how toxic Twitter was. And that's all I saw was that people complaining about how toxic it is. But I didn't see any of the toxicity because Twitter doesn't, like they just weren't sending me that stuff because I'm outside of the Twitter algorithm now.
You know what's interesting about that is that I'm sure that who I follow and your list have a very strong crossover because we're in the same tech
community, same groups and yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. I did not see any of those posts talking about how toxic Twitter is, but I did see a lot of toxic Twitter posts.
That's so interesting, and it all comes down to like they feed it into the machine. And the machine says, well, here's how you're going to get all your money. And they don't think about the fact that this is actually negatively impacting humans' lives. So, yeah, it's scary. But so anyway, I do want to get into the other half of the equation, though. So we talked a little bit about how software writes us, but how we write ourselves into the software. And that has a negative impact, too.
Yeah, it does. So I think that even to your other point of software writes us, I think it's a circle in that. And I think that there's this almost worse disconnect of like, so, you know, we talked about like people in the past, you know, people doing like mind control, right? And really it was like, you know, experiments of like, how do we get people to do what we want, which is advertising and marketing, right? That's what that stuff is used for in present modern times. And when people realize that a person is trying to trick them into purchasing something or influence them in some way, they don't like it. But when a machine is doing it, I think that there's this disconnect that it's like, oh, well, it's just a computer. And so they're not thinking there's a person who is writing the software with the sole purpose of accomplishing the same goal that somebody in a boardroom had an idea for. And what's worse is when we add in this layer of like machine learning, you know, people are like, oh, well, it's just an algorithm that the computer is spitting this stuff out. That means it's true. And that's like almost everybody I know that isn't working adjacent or in that software, that is their baseline understanding, is that an algorithm is math. Math is pure science. Therefore, it's real. And even like people who are not, you know, like in the scientific community and are more, you know, faith-based people I know, like they're not going to say to me that the algorithm is false because they don't not believe in math. You know, they believe that 1 + 1 = 2. So why wouldn't, if you tell them, well, 1 + 2 + 3 = X and you know, that's 5. So X is 5. Then they say, oh yes, that makes sense. Like but you're creating a rule somewhere in there that they're not realizing that like, you and I have created that rule and we don't have all of the context of those rules. So a really good example is like prison software is like trying to determine lengths of sentences, right? So, or whether or not somebody should be released on compassionate release. So they input all of this information. And again, there's a person putting in this information. There's a person writing the software. And so, and then there's a person who is taking the previous data and analyzing it. And they only have their context and their perspective. So the result that they say, here's the trend, here's what's most likely to happen, like regardless of the math, there's going to be that person's opinion written into what they're doing because of the context that they have can become a part of that. Like, and I think it's hard for people to recognize that, like, okay, no, they're not writing in the software. If you're Black, you're getting a longer sentence, but there are reasons that, you know, somebody who is Black may have had certain things in their past that are true, that is maybe more true for people who come from, you know, that are Black than people who are white because of a long history of slavery in this country and not having access to opportunity, access to finances, access to free land, you know, like 100 years ago, those sorts of things, not having access to family because they don't even know who their family is, you know, they were stolen. And so there's all of these other vectors of data that are totally missing from the data. And so when you put that in, well, if you're somebody who's come from a poor background and you're more likely that maybe your parents had to steal so that you could eat, maybe some of these things are true for you. You know, maybe you come from a family that's full of despair and your mom had access to drugs because, you know, maybe she had a mental health problem. Maybe, you know, she was really poor and like was very stressed out and couldn't handle life, which if you just heard that minus the drugs, maybe you could empathize with that, but then you hear the drugs and suddenly you don't empathize anymore. You know, there's all these different vectors of data that are missing from the things that we're writing to determine things. And, you know, when you talk about like credit worthiness, it doesn't sound so bad, but when you start moving into other things, you're like, wow, this is really bad. But we need to like realize that not only are those things that we can like articulate are really bad, but some of these things that seem benign, they're really bad too, because they are, we're writing, somebody else is writing in a bias into software or a multitude of people because they're trying to make money. And we're taking that information as, okay, well, that person is more likely to commit a crime, or, you know, this person is more likely to default on their loan, so they shouldn't be able to own a home. They shouldn't make a certain wage. They shouldn't be able to have insurance. They shouldn't be able to rent, like all of these things. Now I'm getting the bias. I never had that bias, but now I'm accepting this other thing as fact. And now the bias is getting written back into me. And maybe I'm going to go write some software and I'm going to, you know, maybe I get a job in fintech and I believe all of these things about credit worthiness or rental worthiness or insurance worthiness, risk. And now I'm going to go write this into some more software. And it continues to build back and forth until we don't know like what is justice anymore? What is fair?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. That like huge, great words that you've said. And it is a cycle, because I feed those biases into the software that I write, and the software that I write means that those that my software is biased against have an even harder time. And so that that biases the software even further. And that's societal. Like, that's not just software. That's like forever. For as long as society has been a thing, we've had these problems. But I think software enhances that or amplifies yes. that negativity because
it makes the negativity more efficient.
Yeah. Yes, that's well said. Yeah, I totally agree. Now, there's got to be something that people can do about this, at least for themselves and then maybe for others. And you, before we started, you mentioned you have some books that you could recommend for people to read. Do you want to just mention a couple of those and what you like about them?
Sure. So I have a few of them here. So I thought since we have video, like I could have some props. So the first one I actually don't have because I lent it out to somebody. It's called Race After Technology, and it is by Ruha Benjamin. And it is not a cheap book, but it's very big. And I'm sure you could find it at the library. But that book specifically talks about the way that algorithms have created and amplified biases against people of that are Black and other like Indigenous people and people of color. This one is called Technically Wrong, and it's by Sarah. I can't pronounce her last name, but it's sexist apps, biased algorithms, and other threats of toxic tech. This is a really, really good one. It's pretty light read in retrospect, or in relatively, it is a light read relatively to the other one. And it talks kind of how about applications have these biases written into them. And then also they are starting to shape like kids' identities around those biases.
Yeah. Wow. And that when you start messing with kids as they're growing up, my goodness, that is a big problem.
And I think you see, like living where I do in rural suburban, I call it Missouri, you see this polarization like very clearly. Like my daughter, you know, I'm from the West Coast. Like I'm very different than most of the people here. And so for her, you know, she kind of feels that very 180 feeling from her. And she talks about how it's from these social media bubbles and, you know, the creators and influencers and the applications themselves, you know, they're feeding her, you know, what she has kind of gravitated towards, which has helped shape her to what she's like, who's a good person, you know, and she feels that it shapes the bubbles that these others have entered into because of their parents, you know, have shaped them to be what she's deems to be bad people, which I don't necessarily think that there's good and bad people other than some very strong outliers. I think it's really just becoming, you know, we talk about this amplification of that negativity becoming more and more polarizing towards these two different kind of sets of ideals. And there's no more like real gray area. The next one that's really good is called Algorithms of Oppression. And this one is by, I took the dust jacket off of it. Sophia Umoha Noble from the New York University Press. And this is about how search engines reinforce your biases. So again, I mean, it's not something you would think about when you just search for something. You're just looking for an answer, but the answer that you are getting is telling you what the truth is. And it's determining what it is that you think and feel as the truth.
Even the suggestions as you type something, where it suggests an autocomplete for your search, that can give you a sense for what the answer is sometimes.
Yep, absolutely. And I think sometimes too, it can kind of deter you from what you may have been, what maybe your initial bias was. Change that and change your bias for you, because it's basically telling you as a human from a machine you're wrong, you know, like that's not what you were thinking, this is the correct thing. So last one is Hello World, which is Being Human in the Age of Algorithms by Hannah Fry. And this book outraged me. I don't think it's not that I wasn't thinking about, you know, how AI affects literally everything around us, but this one was definitely a bit more broad than like some of these are, you know, very specific to sexist applications or, you know, like specific biases against a certain group of people. This is more broad, like kind of the conversation that we're having, which would be a really good takeaway. And it's, I mean, just over and over about how we're shaping software and then software is shaping us, and it's a circle.
Yeah, that's terrifying, because it's not intentional, or often it's not. And when it is, it's motivated out of
greed,
impure motive. Yeah, greedy. Well, thank you for those suggestions. That's four books that we can recommend to folks. And that's going to be our homework assignment for you all, is to maybe not necessarily one of these books, but just in general to read a book. And these are good recommendations. That expand your perspective on bias and technology and how technology writes us and we write it. And it's a negative cycle if we aren't intentional about making it a good one. So is there anything else that we didn't talk about? We're down to the end of our time here, but is there anything else that we kind of missed that you'd like to bring up before we wrap up?
Maybe in the spirit of biases and, you know, coming from the background I do, like obviously we didn't get too much into it, but, you know, other than I had a rough go of things. And obviously even, you know, getting in my first like 5 years of software were very atypical versus what you see now, and especially where I am now, like very different. I think it's hard to say straight out like, oh, like you can, like, I don't want to say like anyone can be a software engineer, because it's really hard. And would I do the same thing again? Other than the fact that it's had a wonderful effect on my daughter, I don't know that I would. It was very hard, and it still is hard a lot of times. But just to remember that if somebody is a software engineer or they want to be a software engineer, that they can, regardless of, you know, where they're coming from. And it's more about like who I am now is like, sure, is it unlikely that I would have gone to where I am? Okay, but I got here. So like, give me the respect that it doesn't matter that I, you know, don't have a CS degree and dropped out of high school and did a bunch of stuff that I am absolutely not proud of before that.
You know, you mentioned earlier that there aren't good or bad people, and I totally agree with that. And I think that it's just people who do good and bad things. And because every day is a new day, we can make different decisions. And so we can do good things today, even if we did things that we weren't proud of in the past. And now here you are working at Apple as a software engineer, and that's amazing. It's an awesome accomplishment, especially given where you've come from. And I just appreciate you sharing that story with us. And I appreciate you sharing your thoughts on bias and technology. There were like 5 minutes where you gave us some really amazing, like just nonstop thoughts on that. And I appreciate that. But we do need to,
I know you want to wrap things up, but I just thought of this line, from this Tool song that I just always like really speaks to me whenever we're kind of talking about like recognizing that each day, like you can make, you know, have a new intention to like consider the impact that you're leaving on the people around you and the world. And, it's from this song called Right Into, which is basically about how human beings tend to find something and tear it apart, which can be a positive thing or a negative thing. Like I take things apart and put them back together because I want to understand how they work. That's not a bad thing of splitting it right into, but you know, splitting another person right into, not a good thing. So that's that sort of that same aspect. But the line is, repugnant is a creature who would squander the ability to lift an eye to heaven, conscious of its fleeting time here. And that's basically just saying, like, if you don't take the time every single day to think about, like, I have this time on this earth and like I'm lucky for that. I need to like do more than just like think about like what I can take from the world. I should be thinking about what I can do to like leave the people and the places that I've been better than where they were when I found them.
Oh, I love that. You know, not everybody gets to live as old as you are, however old you are. And you should take that as a trust and use that for the better. That was great. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so as we wrap up, Cher, what's the best place for people to connect with you online?
The toxic place known as Twitter. I'm at Cher the Dev. And if you are off Twitter these days or off all of social media, you can also reach me at share@hey.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Cher. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, and we will catch everybody next time.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.